KSFR programming is funded in part by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, keeping watch for the strategies that help create a more informed and just future for all.
Welcome to Here and There. We search near and far to bring you accurate, timely information about important news stories here in New Mexico and the American Southwest, and there, everywhere else. I'm Dave Marish. One of the great privileges of being a local television news anchor, as I was in New York City in the 1970s and early 80s, and then in Washington, D.C. in the late 1980s, is that you get invited to a lot of schools to talk with the children there. Starting in 1973, I talked with kids about news, where and how they got it, and what they thought about it. And one of the first things I learned was that for news, as well as for information and entertainment in general, the generation in school in the 1970s, they came to be called Generation X, was investing a lot more time and focus on screens than on texts on paper. Unfortunately, that investment was being undermined rather than reinforced in public school, where the grammar, logic, and syntax of text was taught over and over, but the grammar, logic, and syntax of communication via what we now call video was ignored completely. And that left the students feeling much less capable of interacting with their TV sets, of questioning and analyzing what they saw and heard, than they did while reading a book or newspaper. Thus was born in me a now more than 40-year obsession with bringing into the mainstream of American public education, as a regular part of the curriculum, lessons that teach children how to watch video, to recognize and understand the defining importance of camera angles, or lighting, or sound, or editing, with all of the choices that it can enforce and all of the tempo that it creates. In other words, the grammar, logic, and syntax of video. Since 2009, the News Literacy Project has taken my idea several quantum leaps further by deconstructing communications techniques and content in the form of news. National Literacy Project classes show how news, video, and text on paper, radio, TV, computer, tablet, or smartphone can inform citizens about their world or mislead them. Starting with three classrooms in Bethesda, Maryland, and New York City, the News Literacy Project today has added thousands of students in Chicago and Washington, Fairfax County, Virginia, Houston, Texas, and I believe Los Angeles as well, to those in Bethesda and New York City. The man behind the News Literacy Project is our guest today. Alan Miller was a career journalist reporting for the Hackensack, New Jersey Record, the Albany, New York Times Union, and the Los Angeles Times. Then one day he visited his daughter's sixth grade class at school and became himself a man obsessed. Alan Miller, thanks so much for joining our Here and There conversation.
Thank you, Dave. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, first, take us back to your daughter's classroom and the epiphany that struck you as you were interacting with the students there.
Well, in 2006, I was then an investigative reporter in the Washington Bureau of the Los Angeles Times, and I was invited to my daughter's school to talk to 175 sixth graders about what I did as a journalist and why it mattered. And I could see, you know, what connected with them. That evening, she brought home 175 handwritten thank you notes so that I could really see what had resonated. And I began thinking about the fact that while this was a long way from investigative reporting, if a lot of journalists brought their expertise and experience to bear, it could be really meaningful. And this was against the backdrop of my growing concern about two things. One was the wrenching transition that was happening in the journalism world, brought on by the rise of the internet and digital media. and also how my own daughter was accessing and evaluating the tsunami of information of varying sources and accountability and credibility that she was getting on her devices. And as it turned out, 2 weeks later, but set up months earlier, I went back to my alma mater, which was Wesleyan University, and was asked to be on a panel on the future of journalism. And we had a great discussion, and the moderator of the panel thanked me, and he happened to be Alberto Ibargüen, class of 66 and president of the Knight Foundation, the largest funder of journalism education in the country. And so we began a dialogue that lasted over the next year plus, myself and the vice president for journalism at Knight, about this idea. And as I was finishing my last four-part investigative series, they were ready to give me a founding grant to launch what became the News Literacy Project.
Now, tell us about, first off, how NLP, News Literacy Project, operates, both in the classroom and now in this digital universe in which we live, reaching long distance into classrooms.
Sure, and I'm happy to give you a little bit of a more sense of our mission. I mean, what we see ourselves as doing is working with journalists and teachers to give students the critical thinking skills to know how to know what to believe in a digital world, what is credible and verified information versus raw information, misinformation, propaganda, and opinion, and to give them an appreciation of quality journalism so they will demand it. And what we do is we use the standards of quality journalism, however imperfect we know this may be, they may be in practice, as an aspirational yardstick against which to measure all news and information, to make determinations about what to believe, what to share, and what to act on. And we use the journalists to help teach students how to think like journalists, because in an information age, everybody is their own editor and everybody can be their own producer. So how do young people play these roles in ways that are credible and responsible and empower their voices? For us, we believe this is a vital survival skill in a digital world, particularly for young people coming from disadvantaged or under-resourced communities. And it is really teaching literacy for the 21st century. So we began in 2009, as you mentioned, with classroom programs in New York City and the Washington, D.C. area and Chicago, and an after-school program as well in New York. Working with the journalists and the teachers, we developed original curriculum, original lessons that were very interactive and engaging. We worked with journalists to come in and bring them in to do lessons as well that would be, again, very interactive, very hands-on. We now have 31 news organizations partnering with us and over 300 journalists in our online directory who have collectively done over 600 lessons in person or virtually since 2009. And then we get students doing projects and actually doing things that build and reflect understanding of the core concepts. So we've been doing this in the class and after school, as I mentioned, for 8 years. But the challenge was we knew that this was not a way that we could get to scale. This was a great laboratory and a great showcase for our work. So in 2012, we developed a digital unit starting in Chicago, and then we did one in New York and D.C., where we retained the voice of the journalist through narrated videos and were able to reach a good deal more students and start to work district-wide instead of school by school. But this was fairly rudimentary. It was something we developed in-house, and we knew we needed something that was more cutting-edge and robust to go to scale. So in the past year and a half, we worked to develop what we call now our Checkology virtual classroom. We want to create a generation of checkologists who will check things out. And we work with a terrific partner in Pittsburgh to build this, build the platform, which is very well aligned with how students get news and information, a lot of emphasis on social media, lessons on things like the role of algorithms to personalize information and viral rumors, in addition to our core lessons on knowing what to believe and the First Amendment, the watchdog role of journalists. We give students basic skills and understanding, and then They get to play the role of an editor or producer deciding what goes on their homepage, which stories, and why. They play the role of a judge in landmark First Amendment cases involving speech and press. They learn about the standards of quality journalism and then apply them as a rookie reporter on a breaking news story. And then it's all pulled together where they learn how to use what we call our check tool, where they can pull in any piece of news or information and apply what they've learned to ask about who created it, for what purpose. Is it news? Is it opinion? Is it propaganda? What are the sources? What's the documentation? Is there bias? Is there elemental fairness? And to make those judgments then in terms of the credibility of what they're seeing. We also encourage them to weigh in when they see errors, to correct them, when they see stories they feel are unfair, to reach out to those who have created them and to ask questions or to ask for corrections or clarification.
Now, Alan,
not only learning the news literacy skills, but really practicing news literacy and out in the real world.
In your really wonderful and explicitly detailed rundown, you left unspoken something which is actually, I think, spoken quite explicitly in the curriculum and in the teaching of the News Literacy Project, and that is what I would call part of most journalists' credo, and that is that we believe that news matters, not just in the sense of being personally informed, but in the context of political democracy, that an informed public is probably the most essential element of political democracy, and making voters not just informed, but engaged is something that, you know, from the written materials that I've been looking over, seems to be, as I say, a very explicit part of the program. And in your post-course testing, you've gotten very gratifyingly good results about the intentions of students in terms of participating both as voters and as rhetorical actors in the world of current events and democratic politics.
So you're absolutely right. I mean, our goal here is to give students the ability to know what to believe, you know, as students, as consumers, and as citizens, and really give them the tools to be informed and engaged in a democracy. And this is the absolute, you know, heart of having a healthy democracy, is having a informed and engaged citizenry. And so we see that as the core, our core mission. And it's one of the reasons that we underscore the importance of the role of a First Amendment democracy and the watchdog role of the press. You mentioned our assessment, and we do a lot of, from the very beginning, we've done a lot of pre- and post-unit survey work with our students and post-unit with teachers. We measure changes in knowledge, attitudes, and behavior from having done our unit. And it's been very gratifying to see that students gain a much greater understanding of what is credible information, of the role of the First Amendment and how it applies to them, of the standards of quality journalism and how it differentiate this work from a lot of other information that is out there. They also tend to consume news in immediately, more readily. And we ask them as well, they also express tremendous confidence, a great deal more confidence in their ability to both create and consume credible information. And then we do ask them some questions about civic engagement, whether they are more likely to do certain things, and we find in very significant numbers, they say they're more likely to correct an error if they find it, they're more likely to post to a blog, they're more likely to write an editor letter to the editor, and in very large numbers, they say that they are more inclined to vote in elections when they're old enough to do so, which we see as sort of the ultimate measure of civic engagement.
Two-thirds of the students who participated in the News Literacy Project in middle schools and high schools said that the courses had made them more likely to vote when they got old enough to do so. Of all the many rewards of the program, I am guessing that single line of evaluation would rank very high.
Absolutely.
Now, one thing that interested me, because I'm a Williams College guy, arch rival to Wesleyan of you and Alberta. I didn't know that Alberta was also a Wesleyan guy. As the NLP has gone from strictly a in-person classroom, conventional classroom instrument, to long-distance learning, and to e-education programs, you have stuck with a pedagogical preference that actually is at the heart of Williams College, which identifies itself in the image of a long-dead professor, and I think he was even at one time president of Williams College, at one end of a log and the student at the other. One-on-one teaching being the ideal of small Ivy League colleges like Williams, Wesleyan, and the dreaded Amherst, who I always like to say was the smallpox blanket guy, Lord Jeffrey Amherst, that is. But you, in your writings, have said, even though the e-education package is susceptible to classroom presentation, your betting was that it is best absorbed one by one of each student on his own laptop computer screen, absorbing all of the details of the News Literacy Project program, not only focused one-on-one on the screen, but able to control the pace and tempo of education by shutting down and walking away when the detail starts to get to be too much. Being a kind of troglodyte myself, I really liked the idea that you will use 21st century technology, but for cognition, the 19th century might have had a really good idea.
Well, you're right. You're partially right on this. That is one of the ways that we anticipate, and we are beginning to deliver the virtual classroom. However, one of the keys of our success is that we've created modules and models that are very flexible, and that leave a significant role for the teacher and a lot of flexibility for the teacher to decide how to use them. So, in the case of the virtual classroom, there is a basic model which can be done one-to-many. There's a single login for the teacher, and the teacher can project it up on a smart board and have the class do everything collectively, do the assessments then collectively. Then there's a premium model where there's one-to-one logins. Every student gets a login. They do the assessment online. The teacher can respond online. There's remediation. There's, as you said, self-pacing. And even that model is blended, which we've seen is the way that e-learning has been most effective. So we do training, professional development with the teachers. We're providing them with a classroom, a guide to go with the platform, so that they can do a mix of class discussion, students doing one-on-one. They can do it what's called the flipped classroom, which you alluded to, where students actually can do it at home or do the lessons on their own, then come in and have discussion or get feedback from the teacher. So the teacher, in whatever model, the teacher still plays a really essential role here, and we're trying to make the best possible use of the technology in a way that's most effective and retains the teacher as a key part of that.
And as you translate knowledge into action, you also translate the fact that while cognition is an individual thing, and often reporting can be an individual thing, the professional practice of journalism is very much a team game, you encourage students to work together in teams as they break out of the classroom and start applying the principles learned there to journalistic or just engaged citizen practice.
Yes, and we've done that. I mean, from the beginning, our classroom program and the lessons we've designed encourage collaboration. We've encouraged pair sharing and discussion throughout. We've given all kinds of prompts for teachers for that. And in the platform, in the premium version, The one-to-one version, there's actually a discuss wall where students and teachers can share their work, share how they've responded to certain of the lessons or mini projects they've done within the lessons, and then they can bring in any piece of news or information, including very current events, things that are happening that day or the day before, and share and discuss them and apply their news literacy skills to those issues or those stories. So, yes, we found, and in terms of some of the student projects as well, we've really encouraged multimedia collaboration for students to use their quite impressive digital skills in terms of creating videos, creating audio pieces, and doing it collectively. And as you said, much like the way journalists tend to work.
Well, you know, the founding fathers worked in very methodical and overall orderly ways. And there's a good reason why the First Amendment went first. We'll talk about that and the role of the First Amendment in the teachings of the News Literacy Project. But first, we're going to take a brief pause. This is Here and There. I'm Dave Marish. Our guest today is Alan Miller, who is the CEO and founder of the News Literacy Project, hopefully coming to a classroom near your children real soon. We'll be back right after these messages. Welcome back to Here and There. I'm Dave Marish. Our guest is Alan Miller, the CEO and founder of the News Literacy Project, a teaching program that uses the content and techniques of news to teach a lot more than journalism, but critical thinking and active participation in political democracy. And just about every discussion of real political democracy in the United States has to begin with the First Amendment. Tell us about the role that the First Amendment plays in the NLP curriculum.
The First Amendment is a central component of all of our programs. We've built everything we've done on what we call our four pillars. So the first is how journalists filter information, determine what is news, and how consumers then filter their information to determine their own news diet. The second is the importance of the First Amendment in the country's democracy and particularly how it relates to the watchdog role of journalism. The third is the challenges and opportunities created by the contemporary information ecosystem. And the fourth is basically how to know what to believe across all media and all platforms by using the standards of quality journalism as an aspirational yardstick. So, as you said, we build on the fact that the First Amendment makes possible the role of a free press. We have a core lesson that looks at landmark cases involving speech and press, primarily involving young people and schools, and then also includes the Sullivan versus New York Times really critical libel case. And then build from there in terms of how essentially the First Amendment is applied to journalism and journalists, particularly in terms of being able to report on abuses and corruption by government and private industry and others in the public interest.
Now, all of this, of course, occurs in an informational universe that has been recently redefined. And folks of my generation, and Alan, I'm going to guess you're a little younger than I am, but even your generation, are still grappling with the changes from what had been a text and then text and TV, but very much sort of organized, institution-dominated system of communication and information to the internet age in which there is more information available and far less controlled information available and far more disinformation or misinformation available. And this kind of redefines the whole process of critical thinking of figuring out what's true, what's false, what's spin, what's bias, what's honest, what's incomplete, what's complete, that is sort of the first pillar once you get those kids settled into class.
Well, there's no question. I mean, the fact is that young people and the population in general has at their fingertips more information by far than ever in human history, and more good information, more valuable information, more credible information, and information intended to inform right there. The challenge is sorting the informational wheat from the chaff. And being, because there's also far, exponentially, far more information that is intended to sell, to persuade, to mislead, to exploit, to incite. And the information, so much of the information is coming through social media. So it's, even the news is disaggregated. People tend to be coming to it through Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. So it sometimes is even challenging to know where this information is coming from, never mind sort of the source and the credibility of the source. So the challenge is having the tools to be able to make those distinctions and to be discerning. And, of course, there's a value for information that's advertising or opinion, but it's very important to be able to make the distinctions as to what the intent is and then what the verification is and the documentation is that undergirds that information as people decide, you know, again, what to believe, what to share, what to act on. And this is critically important whether you're deciding as a student where to go to college or whether to join the military about a first job. But it becomes extremely important then when you move on and talk about decisions about a first vote and participation in the political process.
And, of course, when it comes to knowing what's going on in the wider world, the fact that America's newspapers and television news outfits have been radically reducing the population of foreign correspondents and foreign producers and rely much more now on locally produced both news and, more importantly, video, for viewers at home, it becomes harder and harder to tell what the point of view of the reporter or the camera person who shot the video might have been. And of course, that can be all important. I remember during the years of the wars in Bosnia, the American TV networks would alternately put on video that was shot by the Serbs or by the Croats, say. And of course, they had 180-degree differences of point of view, which was reflected in the editorial choices made in the video. Unfortunately, CBS was quite happy to simply put its eye bug in the lower corner of the screen as if they had shot the video and could be responsible for all of the provenance of it, when in fact that was not true at all. And that was like 15, 20 years ago, 25 years ago. And this problem has only gotten worse as the identity of sources and the description of the interests and points of view of sources, especially for foreign news, get scantier and scantier.
That's absolutely true, and the lines have gotten increasingly blurred, particularly, you know, as you are watching television, cable television, between opinion and news, you know, hard news reporters going on shows and clearly venturing opinions, which I think makes it harder for people to determine the credibility of the news reporting. We've seen a tremendous rise in native advertising and branded content where you've got things that are designed to look like news and stories that actually are either ads or where there's product placement, paid product placement. You know, many news organizations will have a bug that will tell you that this is the case, but it may be quite small. Others don't. We're building a lesson on that right now for the virtual classroom. This is a challenge not just for students, but for any consumer. So the landscape has shifted in ways that just make it very, very difficult by design in some cases. And and by sort of the nature of news and media and the it's the 24-hour, the nonstop news cycle, and then the tsunami of things on social media, and the increasing reliance, as we're seeing in this presidential campaign, on Twitter and Facebook and other sources to distinguish what's credible and believable and what's not.
Now, as the NLP class proceeds, and you confront this question of how do you tell spin from truth, how do you identify the interest expressed by the reporter or the narrator, and how it might shape content, what are some of the clues that are offered to students that they can and should use to be critically thinking about the sort of behind the surface of the daily news?
So as a starting point, we teach that all information is not created equal. We really want to breed a very healthy skepticism, but not cynicism. And the key to that is having kind of the habits of mind that you bring to bear on any piece of news or information that you encounter. So we have kind of our checklist. The first thing you do is you ask if you can tell who created it and for what purpose. Is it created to, in a dispassionate way, to fairly and accurately inform, or is it created to sell or to persuade or to exploit? And so that's the very first thing. If it's intended particularly to inform or to be news, to ask questions about the sources. How many sources are there? Are they eyewitness sources? Are they expert sources? Are they named or are they anonymous sources, which can be a red flag? Do they have an axe to grind? Is there a range of sources and points of view in what you're looking at? Then is there documentation? Is there data cited? Is there statistics cited? Are there reports cited? Again, these all can be manipulated as well, but at least that's a starting point where you can go and look for verification. Is there bias? We have a whole lesson on bias, the nature, the tone, the language. Are you getting a more neutral tone, a more dispassionate tone? Is there clearly, a one-sided piece you're looking at? We do a lot with confirmation bias, an increasingly important phenomenon of people bringing their own preconceived notions to what they're looking at and really looking very often for confirmation of their views rather than information and seeing news through prisms of red and blue. And it's very important to recognize that we all have that. And much like journalists, there's a need to kind of check that and recognize it. We also emphasize getting a range of points of view, not just going to sources you know you're going to agree with. And here again, it's very important to be mindful of the algorithms that are going to be sending things to you that you're more likely to believe and support, your existing views. So is there elemental fairness? Is the subject given a chance to respond or tell their point of view in what you're looking at? And so we feel like these are really critical. They're the same kind of standards that journalists are trained to apply when looking at information and presenting information. And we think as an aspirational yardstick, this is really incredibly valuable to be able to know, what to believe and what to be skeptical of.
Almost all the recent polls show that people under 30 get the majority of their news not from any news institution, not from newspapers or magazines or network news or news channels. They get it on the internet from social media, from friends whom they consider sources, or from the great aggregations that Facebook and Twitter feature. What sort of caveats are taught about the differences between admittedly all too fallible brand name news institutions and the wild and woolly world of social media?
Well, our goal is to give young people the tools to make these distinctions themselves. We don't advocate for any particular medium or platform or outlet. That's not our role. And the truth is that they are getting, the data shows, I mean, they're getting a lot of news through Facebook and Twitter and other social media. It's mixed in with a lot of other things. And so the key is this issue of discernment, because there is so much disaggregation. And that's going only likely to accelerate that process. So for us, again, I think the key is, obviously, if you're using those standards, you are going to be relying more on credible news organizations ultimately for information, because there are standards, there is accountability, there is transparency if they're doing their job well. But our goal is, because it's, again, they're getting this from so many different places, the key is they have that habit of mind to ask those key questions and use that mental check tool to make those determinations on anything that they're seeing or reading or hearing.
Now, so far, what we have been talking about has mostly been abstraction, a description of a course curriculum and teaching techniques that the News Literacy Project uses, its aims and goals. But it's a news project, which means it always is intersecting with reality, using major news stories for case studies. Two that I know have been approached in classrooms by the NLP. One is, of course, the shooting and killing of the teenage Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014, and the ongoing carnival of distortion, spin, bias, and untruth that has been the 2016 presidential campaign. We'll talk about them and how they have intersected with the NLP teaching project, but right now we're going to take another brief pause. This is Here and There. I'm Dave Marish. Our guest is Alan Miller, a longtime journalist for many years with the Los Angeles Times, both on the West Coast, but later more and more as an investigative reporter in their Washington Bureau, and since 2008, the founder and CEO of the News Literacy Project. We'll be back right after these messages. Welcome back again to Here and There. I'm Dave Marish. Our guest is Alan Miller of the News Literacy Project. Alan, news is always about news. Certainly, there are few news stories that have proved to be more impactful and consequential than the shooting of the unarmed African-American teenager Michael Brown by a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri in August of 2014. Tell me how NLP decided that this would be good teaching material, and how it has been used in the classroom to engage and educate students.
So we were actually approached a couple of years back by a very highly respected global education program called Facing History in Ourselves to work collaboratively to develop a news literacy resource around a more current event. They tend to focus on cataclysmic historical events like the Holocaust and civil rights. And together we decided that we would look at the events in Ferguson, specifically the news and information aftermath of the shooting of Michael Brown and the grand jury decision not to indict Darren Wilson, the officer who had shot him, that played out 2 years ago. So we worked with Facing History and have developed a very engaging, rich multimedia resource that has interactive lessons, lots of video, focusing on news literacy using Ferguson as the context. We actually interviewed about 25 people who covered events there or are expert on the news media to get their take, and their bites are interspersed throughout the lessons In one case, particularly noteworthy case, Wes Lowery, the Washington Post reporter, was one of two reporters arrested at McDonald's there on an incident that really put Ferguson on the national and international map. Did a very long interview with us about the arrest that became the basis for a lesson. And of course, events have continued to play out throughout the country that have made this issue of police shootings and police relationship with the minority community very current and very resonant. One of the reasons we chose this topic, and it's so fitting for news literacy, is that you get all of the core elements. First of all, the primacy of social media, the role of Twitter in particular, of putting it on the map, the role of citizens watchdogs, citizens engagement in the journalistic process. You get a very strong look at confirmation bias, people rushing to judgment based initially on early information and often based on points of view. And when further information provided, a much fuller picture. The important role of journalists coming in and providing the verification, and then the watchdog role, providing a great deal more context about the way police systematically treated the African-American community in Ferguson, about the militarization of police in Ferguson and elsewhere, and bringing to light, much broader the societal and systematic issues that Ferguson sort of began to surface.
Well, Ferguson, of course, did produce great examples of in context, in depth, analytical reporting, generally on the 7th to the 70th day. But much of Ferguson was defined by the first 7 days, which epitomized how big stories are covered today, in that there was endless live coverage by just about everybody from the news channels and the networks and the newspapers to self-appointed social media reporters, netizens, who filed their reports and created both a proof and a refutation of the old nostrum that if you have enough monkeys and enough typewriters, eventually somebody's going to write War and Peace. But of course, in the meanwhile, all those monkeys and typewriters are mostly producing monkey gabble. And there was a lot of potentially dangerous monkey gabble produced in the endless stream of live coverage, professional and amateur, at Ferguson. And since it's the nature of news that people tend to remember best what they saw first, and that when the contextual reporting fills things in, they're filling it in against a background of what people already have assumed that they know, just weighing and analyzing and, again, teaching critical thinking about this inchoate mass of coverage of the first 7 days or so of the Ferguson crisis has got to make for very, very interesting classroom interactions.
Well, there's no question. And we've seen this again, more recently in Dallas. We've seen it in other of these fast-moving, fast-breaking, chaotic, very controversial stories where the race to be first, the always-on news cycles, the role of social media, there's invariably, on the one hand, there's more real-time information, there's more on-the-scene, video, primary sources, engagement by citizens, all very positive to the process, but there's also much more propensity for misinformation, for rumors, for false reporting, a rush to judgment. And it becomes incredibly important, I think, for consumers, again, to be skeptical, to try to withhold judgment, to recognize their own biases in what they're looking at, and to follow a story like these stories and others over time from as many different kinds of sources as possible.
You know, in looking through the NLP prism at the 2016 elections, which has have produced so many new phenomena, probably one of the most troubling and most difficult for news consumers is the propensity of the Republican candidate Donald Trump to say very controversial, very explosive, in some cases very dangerous things. And when he's called on them, he says, well, I was just being sarcastic, or I was joking, or what a fool you are to have taken me literally. This is something that journalists have not really seen before, and news consumers are even at a greater disadvantage in trying to weigh not just what's true and false, but what was meant seriously and what was just, you know, something tossed off the top of a comb-overed head.
Well, there's no question. We talk about teachable moments, that this campaign is providing teachable moments on a virtual daily basis. And we actually have a teachable moments blog where we've published some pieces on this very subject. I want to state, you know, we are very much a nonpartisan organization, and it is striking. You know, you've got a race now with the both major party candidates at historic levels of distrust among the public. You know, I think presidential campaigns pose all kinds of challenges because they're rife invariably with spin and with advertising and with misinformation and with propaganda. And as you said, I mean, this year has raised the current race, and particularly some of the challenges posed by Donald Trump, you know, break new ground. And you know, one of the things we steer people to are the fact checkers. And I think that this is a really incredibly valuable service that nonpartisan organizations like PolitiFact and FactCheck.org and the Washington Post fact checker, Snopes.com, that, you know, are assessing the credibility using some of the same, again, tools and standards in real time of these candidates and of the campaign. And that is a valuable source. And then I would, again, use the same standards we've been talking about, putting them to the test here in the case of claims by candidates and assertions by candidates.
So you've gone from a classroom in Bethesda and two in New York City in 2008-09. As you look ahead to 2017 and beyond, what's next for the News Literacy Project?
So I would encourage anyone who's interested to check us out at the newsliteracyproject.org or checkology.org for our virtual classroom. We launched our big pushes on the virtual classroom, and we launched it May 2nd at the tail end of the school year. And in just a couple of months, we were in 22 states and the District of Columbia, and we reached half as many students in those 2 months as we've reached in our first 8 years combined. So we're very excited about the prospect now of bringing news literacy, making it national, and moving ahead with a continued pilot this fall, and throughout the coming school year, with an aspiration to see news literacy embedded in the American educational experience, and to see us in all 50 states, with vastly growing numbers and reach. And we think that, you know, there's a great potential and a great demand for the kind of service we're offering. And I think that demand and that need is really underscored by events like Ferguson and by things like the 2016 presidential campaign, which, as you said, poses all kinds of new challenges for having an informed and engaged electorate.
Well, using both my fingers and my toes from what you just said, that with the addition of 10,000 or so digital students in the e-classroom, the News Literacy Project has now reached more than 30,000 students cumulatively in the last 6-7 years across the United States. So for that, a great beginning, and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
That's going to be our story for today on Here and There. I want to thank our guest, Alan Miller, career journalist with the Hackensack Record, the Albany Times Union, and the Los Angeles Times, and now the president and CEO of the very laudable News Literacy Project. Alan, thanks so much for joining our conversation.
Thank you, Dave. It was a pleasure.
Research and production assistance for Here and There by Amy Marish and Mary Lou Cooper. Operational control by Will Floyd and Sean Conlon. Our theme is by Kate Powell. Here and There is a production of KSFR-FM 101.1 in Santa Fe, New Mexico. You can access podcasts of our programs at the KSFR.org website or on iTunes, search Dave Marish, or at our own website, davemarish.com. You can follow us on Twitter, at Dave Marish, KSFR, and on Facebook, at Here and There with Dave Marish. Join us again when next we go here and there in search of news. Here and There is funded in part by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, keeping watch for the strategies that help create a more informed and just future for all.